Hi, Marco Werman here. We're all on deadline at The World. Our spring fundraiser has just 2 days left, so you only have a limited time for your contribution to The World to be matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of that match, we need to raise $2,500 before May 1st. Help keep access to The World free for everyone. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. Out of the frying pan, into the fire. Many countries were already facing hard economic times before the pandemic. Now disrupted supply chains are making it more expensive to import and move food.
And all of this means added cost until it reaches the customer.
Also today, the Israeli government is tracking cell phones to try and stop the spread of the coronavirus. Many say this crosses a line.
It's without consent. It's very, very harsh and it violates basically privacy.
And in France, it's almost time to get back to work, but French dentists say they don't have enough protective gear. They're protesting by posting online photos of themselves in the office in the nude.
It was not to show us naked. It's just to explain that we are totally defenseless.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. So how's your grocery bill looking? If you've been seeing it steadily rising, it's partly due to increased demand, but also because of disruptions in the supply chain. Take meat. Outbreaks of the coronavirus among workers in U.S. meatpacking plants are slowing things down. In a full-page newspaper ad recently, the chairman of Tyson Foods said the food supply chain is breaking. The Trump White House is trying to prevent any shortages, and last night in an executive order, Trump said his administration would take all appropriate action to make sure meat plants stay open. Labor groups say the order will only force workers back on the job in unsafe conditions. So that's a view from the States. Emily Green has this take on the situation in Mexico.
It was the eggs. That's what Bernardo Vega noticed first. The price for eggs shot up in just weeks.
Más del 50%.
More than a 50% jump. We hope it goes down soon, he says. Vega sells vegetables at a big market in Mexico City. These days, people can't enter the market without masks on and a squirt of hand sanitizer. Vega sells tomatoes, melon, carrots, jicama, and says wholesale prices have roller coastered since the coronavirus crisis hit. Up and down, up and down, he says. People with enough money can ride out these price swings, but that's not the case for Esperanza Resendiz. She's a housekeeper. Since the lockdown, she's been delivering home-cooked meals to her clients instead of cleaning their homes. So she's tracking food costs very closely.
El limón de 15 a 35 pesos. Chile poblano de 16 a 30 pesos.
Lemons, chilies, tomatoes, all staples in Mexico, have roughly doubled in price in the past 3 weeks alone, she says. Beans and tortillas are also up. Bottom line,
pero el caso es el mismo. Ha subido bastante los precios.
Food prices are rising, she says. Why? There's no single reason. Higher prices for fruits and vegetables grown in Mexico might be explained by disrupted supply chains, closed roads, and natural harvest cycles that affect prices. Another reason may be more nefarious. Price gouging, says Ricardo Sheffield. He oversees Mexico's consumer watchdog agency and is now suing merchants caught raising their prices exorbitantly.
First, we started looking at very large retailers, then medium-sized retailers. Now we found out that the main problem is in very small retailers, but we're working at it.
A second issue has to do with higher cost for imported food. Global food prices are set in dollars, and Mexico's peso has lost a lot of value against the U.S. dollar in recent weeks. So imports are a lot more expensive.
The standard price is paid always in dollars. And if there's a devaluation, a rate of exchange is not advantageous for Mexico, then we end up paying more for rice.
And extra costs are passed down to the consumers. Mexico is not alone. Countries like Brazil, India, and Indonesia have all seen their currencies plummet because of the coronavirus. All of this adds to already delicate economic situations for these countries, says Abdulreza Abbasian. He's a senior economist with the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization.
Then once I get that food to my country, I have to move it. But I have a lockdown, I have confinement. And all of this means added cost until it reaches the customer.
Abbasian says disrupted supply chains are making it more expensive to move imported food from point A to point B. Also, some countries are limiting exports on key foods. For example, Russia, a top wheat exporter, is exporting less wheat to make sure it has enough for its own people. So that's driving up wheat prices worldwide.
All of that brings tremendous amount of uncertainty across the world. This uncertainty is very dangerous.
Even the U.S. food market is going through convulsions. Just like in Mexico, eggs were among the first to spike. But the price hikes will hit people in countries like Mexico hardest. Abbasian warns the longer the crisis lasts, the bigger the food problem will become, creating a dangerous cycle of uncertain supply, demand, and eventually hunger. For The World, Emily Green.
When an infectious disease is spreading, prison inmates are especially vulnerable, whether here in the U.S. or among people incarcerated anywhere in the world. Photos posted online this week show what I mean. Hundreds of inmates jammed together on a cement jailhouse floor, stripped to their underwear. This is in El Salvador. Their heads are shaved. Some of them have face masks, but not all. El Salvador's government released the pictures to publicize their crackdown inside prisons, coming after gangs outside the jails killed dozens this past weekend. In response, authorities have started sealing off the doors and windows of prison cells. The country's prison's director warned that not a single ray of sunlight is going to enter any cell. Rosa Anaya runs Segundas Oportunidades, or Second Chances. It's a Catholic relief services program that rehabilitates inmates in four prisons in El Salvador. Rosa, thanks for being here. You've been inside some of El Salvador's prisons. What do these photos show and what don't they show about life in prison there?
So what you see in the pictures is one of the very many faces of reality in the prison system in El Salvador. For years, the system has had overcrowding. We're the second country right below the United States that has most incarcerated people per capita. There is 28 different prisons in this country, and there is one national university to give you an idea of where we're putting our investment and money.
Why do you think Salvadoran officials decided to release these frankly shocking photos of the prison crackdown now?
In El Salvador, some people might think that this is the answer because there's a lot of hurt. There has been decades of violence and a lot of victims that are hurting. I'm a victim myself of violence. During the war, my father was assassinated. And one of the greatest things that we've been trying to push is for justice, yes. But justice does not equal, you know, repression. It's not vengeance. Any one of us, under the right circumstances, as we've seen in those pictures, can become the one that humiliates and creates violence. So how do we want to be portrayed? How do we want to be helped into healing our wounds? Because all of this is part of trauma that has not been dealt with in decades in this country. So some people might think that this is a good idea, and that's why it's been showed and portrayed like it's something good that is happening.
I've seen reports from San Salvador of a surge of violence in the past week. Does that explain why these photos have been put out now? And is it messaging from the government that they mean business with any violent people?
Gangs aren't the only ones generating the violence, but they're the easiest target because they look the part. We have to go beyond the idea of the enemy and start looking at how does this society, Salvadoran as a whole, start to bring the idea of the world that we want to live in. And that includes our children that might or might not be part of a gang, because at some point we need to have a place for everybody. And if we still keep on going with the mindset of the other and humiliating the other, then we're not going to get to that place that we all want to be in. All Salvadorans want peace. You know, to dream about our children having a different space But it's just the easy way to sell this thing is that there is one enemy that we have to combat. And we forget that it is not one enemy. It is a culture of violence that needs to shift.
Rosa Anaya runs Segundas Oportunidades, or Second Chances, a Catholic Relief Services program that rehabilitates inmates in four prisons. She's been speaking with us from San Salvador. Thank you very much, Rosa. It's great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
With borders tightly closed and society in lockdown, think about migrants. They were on the move. Now they're stuck. There's a notoriously untamed stretch of jungle between Colombia and Panama. Some 2,000 people there, many of them children, have nowhere to go. The World's Jorge Valencia reports.
They say it's one of the most dangerous places for migrants across the Americas. It's about 60 miles of thick and humid rainforest, and it's controlled by drug traffickers and petty criminals. Many who dare walk through what is known as the Darien Gap either die or get killed. Yet people keep trying because it's the only land route from South America into Central America. This group is mostly from Haiti. They've been detained for months where they emerged from the rainforest in Panama.
Okay, good morning.
One man starts speaking in the video, which was uploaded to social media from the Darien Gap. He's clutching an empty water bottle as a crowd surrounds him, and someone motions for him to speak.
We're dead up here. We have no security. We don't have no hospital. We don't have no doctors. We don't have no nursing. So please, we need immigration to come here to say something about it.
If conditions emerging from the rainforest were not precarious enough already, officials now say the coronavirus has reached this remote patch of land. And the Panamanian government says migrants have to stay put. Juan Manuel Pino is Panama's public safety minister.
Debido a la pandemia, los migrantes deben mantenerse en su área asignada.
Pino spoke recently wearing a face mask in a televised address.
Todo el mundo está paralizado, quedaron aquí estancados y deben respetar las normas.
The entire world is paralyzed, he says. The migrants are stuck here and they have to respect health regulations. A majority in the Darien Gap right now are from Haiti. Others flew to South America from much farther away. Nepal, Bangladesh, Burkina Faso. Kyung Sung Kim is the UNICEF representative in Panama. She says about a third of the migrants are children, and most of them are under the age of 5.
We are scaling up our response in terms of procurement of mattresses and things that are basic needs. Cleaning products, construction materials, hygiene kits, jerry cans for water. It might not be as fast as we would like to, but we are doing our best.
Local officials say they believe the coronavirus was brought to the Darien Gap by government workers traveling from Panama City. Aid workers said that last week there were 20 cases of migrants showing symptoms and that those people were being held apart from the general population. Access to drinking water is an issue, says Walter Cot, regional director for the International Federation of the Red Cross.
Cleaning, hygiene, sanitation are big matters, especially because the density of the population there, they are very close and it's very easy to have an infection running very quickly among them, and we need to really pay attention to that.
Humanitarian workers in the Darien Gap aren't paying attention only to the migrants. The local population is mostly subsistence farmers who are no longer working because of the pandemic. Nadine Gonzalez is the local mayor.
También hemos atendido la población que reside en la comunidad donde están los inmigrantes.
We're working with the local community, González says, providing them with food so they don't have to leave their homes.
Trabajaban la agricultura, iban a trabajar jornaleros que trabajaban el día de trabajo y al momento de que todo el mundo.
They're day laborers, so when they stay home, they don't make any money, González says. In the video uploaded by migrants, another man from Haiti says people are sleeping on the ground and that they've run out of money to buy food. The man says they won't die from the coronavirus. He says they'll die instead from isolation, from hunger, or from thirst. And he asks, why don't they just let us through? For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Cargo ships around the planet, crews of sailors who can't get home. That story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. Hi, this is Marco Werman. Our spring fundraiser has just 2 days left. We know you value what we do here at The World. I'm asking you to demonstrate that through your financial support. These days more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking for your support today. Every contribution made in support of The World will be matched. We still need to raise $2,500 before May 1st to take full advantage of this generous match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link in the podcast notes. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Many cities, states, and countries around the globe are having the debate of how long lockdown should continue and when stay-at-home orders should be lifted. But what if your home is an oil tanker or a cargo carrier? You can't get off. There's nowhere to go. 750,000 crew members aboard these vessels are finding they can't go home. Let me repeat that number. 750,000 crew members out at sea right now. Nick Chubb is a former ship's navigator. He's currently director for the maritime technology intelligence platform Theseus and joins us from London. So what's going on here, Nick? Why can't crew members get off the ships?
Of the world's 1.5 million seafarers, around half are at sea at any one time. And then half are at home waiting to join into a ship. And when you join a ship, you stay for anywhere between 3 and 9 months for most ocean-going ships. Each month, around 100,000 seafarers either get off the ship or join a ship. And it's actually quite a big logistics operation in itself, moving all of those people around the world. Obviously, since the lockdown began, we've had a whole load of seafarers who are reaching the end of their contract, unfortunately having to stay on board the vessel because they're just simply, their relief can't get to the ship. And potentially in some cases, even worse, is they've managed to get off the ship, but they're stuck in a foreign port because there are no flights home. So it's quite a serious situation.
Earlier this month, a spokesperson for the International Chamber of Shipping said that there could be terrible accidents at sea if shipping crew changes continue to be blocked. So aside from things like oil spills, what accidents could he be referring to?
Driving a ship or navigating a ship, it's a bit like flying a plane. It's quite a complex job, and there's a lot to it, and it takes a lot of teamwork and a lot of communication, not just on board your own vessel, but also with other vessels in the area. And if you've been on board a ship for any particular length of time, you'll find that fatigue starts to set in. You'll be working a watch shift pattern that might be 4 hours on or 6 hours on and then 8 or 6 hours off. And over time, that builds up. And as people extend beyond their normal contract length, it's a bit like a pilot being asked to fly a plane longer than they should be.
Can these vessels dock anywhere right now, or are they literally floating around with nowhere to go?
It completely depends on the situation. To be clear, most ships are docking, which is why we're all still able to get food and clothes and the goods that we need. It's just that the crews can't get off where they dock, or if they can't get off, they get stuck in the city. So actually, incredibly, the hundreds of thousands of seafarers out there who are working incredibly hard, keeping our supply chains moving, we're all dependent upon them. But when it actually comes to us being able to sort of pay them back by sending them home, we can't do it. And that's the real problem. So the ships are moving around the world and trade is flowing. But the people who make it happen are suffering as a result.
So in your prior job, Nick, you worked on one of these vessels, an oil tanker specifically, and you were at sea for long stretches of time. What's that like? And I'm wondering if you could kind of extrapolate the kind of pressure these seafarers are under right now with coronavirus.
There's a kind of running joke in the industry that being at sea is a bit like being in prison, except there's no TV. It's quite a good analogy. You can't get TV or radio signal. There's no internet on the vast majority of these ships. And the conditions on board can vary from being very comfortable to being pretty cramped and not great food. And it just completely varies from shipping company to shipping company. So certainly being away from home for an extended period of time, I was once away for 4 months and I found out my contract was being extended by another 3 weeks. And just on a psychological and emotional level, I found that incredibly difficult to deal with. So I've just got no idea how these people who have been away for 9 months already and are being told that there's no end in sight for them, how that must feel.
Nick Chubb in London. He's a director for the maritime technology intelligence platform, Theseus. Thanks for being with us, Nick.
Thanks, Marco.
Sometimes the best way to learn a new skill is to just do it, like picking up a new language or learning how to bake or drive. Turns out this is also the case for Bronze Age swordsmanship. Yep, you can learn that too. A team of archaeology researchers has added sword fighting to its to-do list. Raphael Hermann is an archaeologist at the University of Göttingen in Germany.
Anything you ever see on TV about sword fighting is just Hollywood. There's no big arching movements. There's no exchanging blows, etc., etc. in that sense. And what really surprised me is how close you are to the opponent most of the time. You can literally look them in the eye. You can smell the breath if you're unlucky. It's extremely fast as well. So you don't have much time to think, hey, what am I going to do next? You have to train so much that your body automatically knows what you can do.
So you're studying bronze swords for this particular project. And I gather bronze swords were found pretty commonly, are found commonly all over Europe. But historians were not convinced that people actually fought with bronze swords. Why is that?
People thought it was such a soft material. They thought it would never be able to withstand clashes in a battle or anything like that. So instead, they thought, hey, they look very pretty. They're very shiny. The ones we find in the ground are normally green because they're corroded. But when you make a new bronze sword, it almost looks like a golden sword. So people thought, hey, these are very high status symbols. People just had them for ceremonial or status purposes, and they couldn't have been used in sword fighting. But nobody ever tried it. Nobody actually took a bronze sword into battle until about 15, 20 years ago. And then we were getting the first insights that, hey, actually, these swords really do hold up quite well. You can use them. They don't immediately break. They don't necessarily bend, or they don't deform in any sort of way. We just still didn't know how the fighting was actually conducted. We didn't know what people were actually doing with the swords.
So your research changed that. What did you actually do in your research to challenge that belief?
So previous approaches were just people essentially having a replica and just hacking at things, and they then determined, hey, this sword really stood up well. But we wanted a much more scientific approach to the whole topic. So about 20 years ago, there was a method developed which is called metalwork wear analysis. Every time you use any sort of metal tool and you use it on other materials, it leaves minimal traces, microscopic traces on it. You can then figure out, okay, this sword has the trace, maybe a bulge. And if you do an experiment and says, okay, this experiment has also shown this is how a bulge was made, then you can get a pretty clear idea of how the swords were used in the past. For example, during these fights, we could show that you would never try to parry with the flat side of your bronze sword. This is a technique often used in the Middle Ages. With an iron sword, it preserves your cutting edges. But if you do it with a bronze sword, it immediately bends your sword and you can't use the sword anymore.
So you're an archaeologist, Raphael. Is this hands-on approach becoming more common in archaeology? Is there something that the experiential method can teach you that you just can't learn from reading a historical account or examining an artifact?
I think absolutely. The problem with particularly experimental archaeology, people didn't do it scientifically for a long time. People just went out in the woods, for example, and built a hut for their own pleasure and gained something out of that. But in order to do science, which is at the end of the day what we as archaeologists were trying to do, you have to have proper experiment protocols. You have to record everything. It has to be completely reproducible. And particularly with this paper, particularly for Bronze Age combat, I think we've almost created like a blueprint for other researchers how they can expand on this research. There's so much more stuff out there that needs to be done. There are thousands and thousands of weapons in Europe alone. We've done over 150 experiments, but we've only just scratched the surface, really.
Raphael Hermann, an archaeologist at the University of Göttingen in Germany. Thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
News headlines are next. You're with the world. The wristwatch is from Switzerland, the TV from Japan, the car from Germany, but the internal parts in all those products crisscross the planet, courtesy of complex global supply chains.
They've been built out over the last three decades, they've become very long, they've become very efficient, and they've all been disrupted.
When supply chains break during a pandemic, that's still ahead here on The World. By now, we've all heard about contact tracing, tracking the movements of people with COVID-19 to see whom they came in contact with and may be infected. Many countries are using digital tools to do this. Israel has been tapping into huge batches of cell phone location data. Some say it's smart public health. Others say the Israeli government is crossing a line. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
Last month, in mid-March, the Israeli government did something really controversial. So controversial that people responded by taking to the streets during a pandemic. Here's what happened. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet passed an emergency measure that gave the Shabak, that's the country's internal security agency, a new power to use advanced cyber tracking tools to stop coronavirus from spreading. Karen Elzari is with the Cyber Research Center at Tel Aviv University.
The idea was to use cellular location data to track the movements of confirmed coronavirus carriers so that they are able to hopefully minimize their exposure and identify any exposure they might have with additional people.
This kind of cell phone location data is typically used for anti-terrorism work in Israel. Tapping into it for civilian surveillance is unprecedented, and it's made a lot of people nervous for a couple reasons. For one, it wasn't clear exactly what information the Shabak authorities had access to, how they'd use it, and how long they'd hold on to it. And second, Israel's parliament, the Knesset, had no say in the creation of the tracking program. It was passed as an emergency measure. In fact, at the time, there was no sworn-in government, only an interim one. Israel's had several inconclusive elections this past year.
So that kind of created an atmosphere where there was this feeling where we don't have a fully elected sworn-in government, and we do have these new emergency regulations that are giving more and more power to use technology tools for tracking of civilians.
One of the people this concerns is Sharon Abraham Weiss. She's with the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, a human rights organization. She says Israel is the only democracy in the world relying on its security agency to track the spread of COVID-19. But in a democracy, she says, privacy is a basic human right.
The moment a security agency is authorized to collect data on civilians to deal with non-security issues, such as the COVID-19, we cross a red line.
This is why her group, along with several other organizations, filed petitions to Israel's Supreme Court. In response, the court ruled that a parliamentary committee had to oversee the tracking program. That was last month. And just a few days ago, on Sunday, there was another ruling that activists consider a victory. It said that for the tracking program to continue, it has to be authorized through a legislative process, and that journalists have to get special exemptions from tracking to protect them and their sources.
I think the Supreme Court here came with a very balanced decision.
Nimrod Kozlovsky is a technology lawyer in Tel Aviv.
On the one hand, the Supreme Court acknowledged that while there was an urgency when they started using the tracking technology a few weeks back, when the coronavirus erupted, now the court believes that there is not the same sense of urgency, that now we have the time to enact a law.
A law that he hopes addresses some of the big questions left unanswered by the emergency regulation, like how the data will be collected, stored, and processed. Karine Nahon agrees. She's the president of the Israel Internet Association, among many other things. She's a big deal in Israel's tech scene. She actually advised the parliamentary panel that was tasked with overseeing the Shabak's coronavirus tracking program. And she expects she'll be called on to advise the Israeli parliament when they start drafting up a law.
I would like to find a solution that is proportional, that allows the people more privacy. Right now, the technological measurements of the Shabak is, we don't know how it works. It's a surveillance program, and it's without consent. So in a way, it's very, very harsh, and it violates basically privacy.
Nahon says ideally the tracking program would be voluntary, people would opt in, but she's adamant that Israel's internal security agency should stay out of it.
You don't want to create measurements that later you'll be sorry for implementing them.
Today, she says, it's the coronavirus.
Tomorrow, somebody else is going to ask for using the Israeli security agency to basically solve civilian problems.
It's a steep, slippery slope, she says, one that could quickly and dramatically impact government surveillance in her country, for now and for generations to come. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
In our hyper-connected world, if a factory in Asia, Europe, or wherever goes idle, that can reverberate across the globe. Delays in a particular bolt for a specialized piece of machinery is one thing, but interruptions to food delivery, that's another, and it's a worrying development. Here to make sense of things is Craig Heyman. He's an expert in global supply chain management and is also the CEO of Aviva, a tech software company based in the UK. So, David, first of all, President Trump issues an order that meatpacking plants in the U.S. stay open. It's a way of securing food supply. What breakdowns in global food supply chains are you starting to see?
Well, I think you're talking about the labor aspect around supply chains. And so anything that has got a substantial amount of labor into it, that's where the first sort of a most immediate aspect is. But of course, in many supply chains, there's been a push to automate. So you have many other consumer packaged goods, for example, or medical pharmaceuticals, where it's already heavily automated. And in those situations, you're working to try to avoid having to go in and fix those facilities. You want them to keep running.
So medical pharmaceuticals, that's one industry. What other industries are kind of sending out SOS alerts right now about their supply chains?
Well, you know, also think about the length of those supply chains. They've been built out over the last three decades. They've become very long. They've become very efficient. And they've all been disrupted, whether that's manufacturing, the transportation, whether that's government policies. So any of those sort of long, highly efficient supply chains are having to reroute to become closer, more onshore, more domestic, perhaps more provincial than they were before.
So take us into kind of the global aspect of that food supply chain. Can you give us an example of kind of how long that chain is?
In some cases, 3 months. In some cases, it can be within a few days. So, for example, you could have here in the UK, when you go to the store and you pick up a pack of tomatoes, it would show you which farm it was picked from in the UK mostly. Whereas if you're in the United States and you're picking up a package of tomatoes, it's pretty much coming from somewhere outside of the United States. But of course, then you've got the transportation of it, the energy around the transportation of it, the packaging of it becomes really important.
Craig, when this is all over, whenever that is, what recess do you think will happen in global business resulting from the troubles we're seeing with global supply chains?
I think about habits and how long does it take to make a habit and how long does it take to break a habit? So let's take, for example, working from home. We've all been working from home here for at least 5 weeks. Likely, I'm thinking that we're going to be working from home through the end of September at least. And at what point does that change our habits as consumers and our consumption patterns? I think that will be a substantial change. How we travel, how we consume energy, how we consume products, that will be a substantial change. And then back to the supply chain, the supply chains are very difficult to evolve. So manufacturers really are now working really hard to go through this digital transformation.
A personal question, Craig. Your father was an engineer. What did you learn from him in terms of supplies and keeping stock and inventory moving?
Well, I think you always have to plan for the worst, but also be optimistic. And also accept the reality as it exists, not as how you wish it would be. And for that, you use data. You use data every day to change how you see the world. You look in the mirror every day and you see how it actually is, not how you wish it would be. And then you go forward and try to learn and how to respond to the world as it is today.
Craig Heyman is the CEO of Aviva Group, a tech software company based in Cambridge, England. Thank you very much for your time, Craig.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Indian actor Irfan Khan died today. He was 53. Khan was beloved by Bollywood fans, best known for his work in independent films. He was introduced to Western audiences in movies like The Life of Pi, Jurassic Park, and Slumdog Millionaire. Slumdog's British director Danny Boyle remembered Khan's influence today.
Irfan saw the possibility of guiding our audience with his dignity, his grace, his charm, his intelligence, and his calmness.
In 2018, Khan began treatment for neuroendocrine cancer. He recovered enough to shoot what would become his final movie, Angrezi Medium. The film's release has been delayed by the pandemic. News of Khan's passing today led to an outpouring of emotion from his fans. Many have been sharing a clip of this moment from The Life of Pi.
You know, I've left so much behind. My family, the zoo, India, Anandi. I suppose in the end, the whole of life becomes an act of letting go. But what always hurts the most is not taking a moment to say goodbye.
The whole of life becomes an act of letting go. Deep words today, Irfan Khan. Goodbye from all of your fans. In South Korea, there's a news story that has captured the public's attention, and it is not connected to the pandemic. Young women who got blackmailed, a scheme that then exposed an online sexual abuse racket. It was broken up by authorities. There were dozens of victims. From Seoul, Kelly Kasulis reports.
South Korea has been through a series of sexual abuse scandals in recent years. Here's what happened with this latest one. The perpetrators collected private information on dozens of women and young girls around the country. Then they blackmailed their victims into performing sex acts on camera. Often cruel and degrading, the videos were shared on the Telegram messaging app and chat rooms under the title The Nth Room. Over time, copycat chat rooms on other apps started to crop up.
The Nth Rooms shocked me because of the way these women were treated and the things they were coerced into doing.
Haedeon Kang is a journalist and filmmaker in Seoul. She says she's fed up with sex crimes like these after years of covering them for the news.
Yes, those acts were shocking to me, but what shocked me even more was the callousness of the language and how people just talked about rape as if it was a joke. And that's just not okay.
News reports say these chat rooms attracted more than 250,000 users. They paid for access to videos, mostly in cryptocurrency. The creator of the Nth Room was busted by police in March. More than a dozen arrests came soon after. It's been a huge scandal here, but many people are reluctant to talk about it publicly. Choi Da-eun is the director of the Korean Women Lawyers Association. She gives legal help to women who become victims of digital sex crimes. She says what happened in the Nth Room is even hard for her to talk about. And that's despite working with sex crime victims for years. She tells me that crimes like these are sensitive subjects for many South Koreans. They find it hard to imagine something so perverted and sadistic happening in their country, she says. Choi says some people dismiss the scandal as another case of internet porn, not real-world violence. In other words, they just don't see it as a big deal. But after the news came out, more than 2 million people signed a petition calling on police to reveal the identity of the main suspect. And his name did come out. Cho Ju-bin was the chat room's 25-year-old creator. And that's another thing that's added to the public outrage. The age of the suspects. Several of those involved in sharing content from the Nth Room or running similar chat rooms are under 17 years old. One of them is only 12. Yi Soo-jung is a professor of criminal psychology at Kyunggi University. She's trying to improve laws on digital sex crimes, and she says the case was not a surprise to her. Yi tells me she's been worried about something like this happening for years. There's a growing trend of tech-savvy runaway children in the country, she says. And many of them end up committing crimes or becoming victims in cases like these. She believes that's probably the case with several of the minors involved with the Nth Room. As many women see it, though, this scandal is just the latest example of a disturbing trend of misogyny and violence against women. In 2018, tens of thousands of women rallied to protest a different scandal. Criminals were planting spy cameras in women's public bathrooms and then selling that footage online. Haedeon Kang says it's not easy for women in Korea to push back in public.
To say that you're a feminist is actually still quite a taboo subject. I know that's quite surprising, but in the Korean context, it's still seen as something that's uncomfortable and it's something that's controversial.
The suspects in the Nth Room case are facing charges including child pornography and sexual assault. Some of the women I spoke with say they're worried about the perpetrators getting only light sentences. But Choi Da-eun, the lawyer, says the case seems to have caused a bubble to burst in South Korea, and she believes it'll have a massive impact in the end. Because now, so many women are watching so closely. For the World, Kelly Kasulis, Seoul.
This might sound like patting ourselves on the back. The media have been vital during this pandemic. But like businesses everywhere, many news operations are suffering financially right now, especially those serving immigrant communities in the U.S. Here's the world's Rupa Shenoy.
You've got a lot of time as a trucker.
Sonny Graywall has a refrigerated truck. He hauls dairy and fruits and vegetables.
Punjabi Radio USA sound rahe sare himanjo ka te.
At first, listening to Punjabi Radio USA was something just to break up the silence. Graywall's dad got him into it about 8 years ago. Their family's from India.
So he was always listening because my dad basically speaks our native language, the Punjabi language.
And Punjabi Radio USA is all Punjabi language, all the time. Now it's become a lifeline for Graywall and the tens of thousands of other Punjabi-speaking truck drivers in the U.S. In some areas of California, they can hear it on the radio. In other places, truckers stream it or call a number to listen. There's a whole show about trucking where people can call in and ask an expert questions. After the coronavirus hit, these truckers started reporting problems with the rest stops they rely on for bathrooms and food.
Yeah, so there were a lot of people were calling in and telling them, hey, this company don't let us use the restroom. They don't even let us go inside.
So we became a platform on them so that they can tell their issues.
Raj Karambir Singh is one of the two main hosts of California-based Punjabi Radio USA.
And slowly, people who were listening, somebody who was listening in Indiana, I will provide you sanitizer, gloves on this truck stop.
People across the country started organizing help for truckers. Singh has also brought on doctors, lawyers, and other experts to tell people about all aspects of the pandemic, like who's at risk, who gets stimulus checks, and who qualifies for unemployment.
It became more intense. It took more of our time. Although we got financially hit with the coronavirus because a lot of our advertisers, they had to shut down their businesses. So that way we lost advertisers as well.
That's a problem for many mainstream media companies right now. But a new report from the City University of New York's Center for Community Media argues news outlets like Punjabi Radio USA are vital and need to be supported because they're the only trusted sources of information on specific problems facing some immigrant groups. Daniela Gerson wrote the report. She calls media organizations like Punjabi Radio USA digital first responders.
They're seeing record traffic, but at the same time that they're seeing record traffic, their contracts are being canceled. And the reason is that media outlets serving immigrants depend on other small immigrant businesses for the most part.
Gerson says many digital first responders for immigrant communities have been hit hard. For example, the Noi Viet Daily News, the largest Vietnamese newspaper in the U.S., has cut staff. Another one is Jambalaya News out of New Orleans.
The women behind that news outlet, which is just the only Spanish language source for the community, are not paying themselves right now.
Punjabi Radio USA plans to keep going despite the financial situation, says host Raj Karambir Singh.
The thing is that the information what we are giving, nobody else is giving, so not everybody is doing what we are doing for our community right now.
Sonny Graywall is counting on that information to help navigate the current economy, which has been really hard on people like him who own their own trucks. They're getting paid a lot less to haul freight, even though farmers have produce that needs to be shipped across the country.
We are basically not even surviving right now. The rates they're offering, you can't even survive.
Graywall says now it costs him more to run his truck than he earns taking a job. So for now, he's parked it in Buffalo, New York, where he lives. He still dials into Punjabi Radio USA, hoping the hosts explain how truckers can manage their loan payments during this crisis.
They figure it out. They find out. Then they tell everybody on the radio. That's when I find out. Then I can call my lenders and try to skip my couple payments or defer the payment or something.
Whatever happens, Graywall trusts Punjabi Radio USA and his community, their listeners, to help. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
It'll be a couple of weeks more in France before people get back to work. Right now, French dentists are feeling especially vulnerable. Many of them say they won't have enough gear to protect them from the coronavirus. So they're protesting in a unique way. They're stripping down. Dozens of dentists across France have taken pictures of themselves naked in their offices and posting the photos online with the hashtag Dentiste à poil, dentist in the buff. Maude Brown posted one of the photos. She works as a dentist surgeon in Aubernais near Strasbourg. Why get naked, Maude? What does that show?
To explain, that's
If tomorrow the health ministry doesn't free up the stock of PPE that is currently blocked or let us the possibility to order, it will be like going naked at work. The fact is that because of the shortage of masks in the hospital, all dentists make a donation of their stock of PPE. So without protection for us and for our patients, it's really impossible to face the COVID.
What has the French government been saying specifically about the dentist profession? And what's been their reaction to the protest?
In fact, they promised us 150,000 FFP2 masks to protect ourselves, but it's not enough for 42,000 dentists. It will just only last for one day of work.
Your father there in Aubernais, where you work, he's also a dentist. What does he think about the naked protest?
I posted a photo of me and also a picture of my father. He's 72 years, so he's very united with the movement also. We both love our profession. We love taking care of our patients, and we try to defend our dental profession.
Maybe I'm looking at him now. Is he wearing a plexiglass face mask, and does he
yes.
have glasses
yes.
straddling
it's
the back of the chair?
It's to tell, because if tomorrow he has to work, he has to put on himself what he can find. So it's just impossible to work like this.
And looking at your photo, I just have to mention that you've got some serious body ink. How many dentists do you know
you.
who have such nice tattoos?
Yes, I think I have shocked all the US with my photo. I'm sorry. It was not to show us naked. It's just to explain that we are totally defenseless. So it was really to shock maybe a little bit the opinion, but to alert the authorities. And we are all united in this movement. All the dental profession is united. We have made 260 photos for the moment, and it's going to grow and grow all over the world.
Well, it is very tasteful, and anyone who hasn't seen the human body naked, it's about time. If they have seen it, it won't be shocking. Maud Brown, surgeon dentist in Aubernais in France, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You can see some of those naked dentist photos online at theworld.org. Yeah, don't all rush at once, everybody. Also, we reached out to the French Ministry of Health. In a statement, they said they were working to supply French dentists with all the necessary protective gear. And that's going to do it for us. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.